I said, but you are the most special person in the world. And I'm Tony Curry, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to pull this hide there, and I'm going to pull this down a little bit. My daughter still reminds me that I'm small for my age. And I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is May 3rd, 1975. And I am so grateful to be here. And Dick, thank you so much for inviting me. And Barbara, Barbara and Dick are just the most special people in the world to me. They are wonderful, and I love them dearly. And I'm so happy to be here. Woodstock, sober. What a concept. Who'd have thunk it? So it is a great honor to be here and to be in this company of a powerhouse of speakers who have been my teachers for all my life, like this Tom sitting on the front row down here, been a teacher for all my sober life and all the others as well. So I am really, really lucky to be here. And Dick could not ever have known this, but and I'm a therapist in Atlanta. He does know that. I'm a therapist in Atlanta, and my card says Tony G. Curry. And the Griffin, the G stands for Griffin. And all of the Griffin reunions, except one, I think, has been held right here at this motel. So I have been here many times, and it really reminds me of what a great family I have and how much I owe that family for my alcoholism. Because they were all connected. And if this is a genetic disease, boy, I had a really good start. Because in that Griffin family, there was a grandfather Griffin who quit drinking before I was born and was the meanest man I have ever known. There was no AA around to teach you how to live back then. He was mean. I was terrified of him. I ran away from him every time I saw him. And he was a dry drunk. That's what he was, a dry drunk. And he had 8 children, 2 daughters who chose never to drink and therefore were not alcoholic, 6 sons, one of whom chose never to drink and therefore was not an alcoholic, and 5 raging alcoholic sons. And my father was one of those. And so I just didn't have a prayer. The genetics were all over my family, so I didn't have a prayer. My brother became addicted to alcohol and numerous other things. He might have been at the Woodstock, the first Woodstock. He might have been there because he certainly qualified for that one. And unfortunately, he died at a very young age, 54, of alcohol and drug-related problems. So that was a real sadness for him because he was so smart. If any of you know who Bill Curry is, Bill Curry says my brother taught him everything he knew about football. So I was so happy to hear that. I just saw him at our reunion, my 53rd reunion, high school reunion. That's 71 if you're trying to figure that out. So... But this place is very special to me for the family reunions as well, and now very special to me for Woodstock of the South. I'm so glad we have that here now, and thanks to Dick, we do. And I'm so thrilled to be a part of it and to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you. And I have found everything that I was ever looking for in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I came into this world with the ism. I had the genetic ism when I was popped out of the womb. And I was miserable as a child. I never felt a part of. I never felt like I was okay. I was shy. I couldn't talk to anybody. I couldn't be around anybody. I was afraid of other children. I'm just miserable. I would stay in my room and listen, close the door and listen to music. My husband says, how do you know the words to all those songs from the 40s? Because I was in my bedroom with the door closed trying to get away from the world, and I listened to all those songs from the 30s and 40s, and I know all the words to them today, too. And that's the way it was. I was just miserable. There was nothing that I wanted about the life I had. Now, on the outside, there was absolutely nothing that said I was not okay. It's like Clancy talks this about being the disease of perception. On the alcoholism side of it, the perception is I'm worthless. I'm a no good. I don't fit in. I can't do this. I don't like these people. They don't like me. I'm just not a part of. But the reality is that I was an officer in every class in my elementary school and high school. I was on the homecoming court. I was president of the bank, president of the student council, president of the bank, president of the course. I was editor of the annual, copy editor of the newsletter, honor graduate of the 1956 graduating class, and most of those things were elected. But do you know that the last 2 years of my high school life, every lunch hour, I spent in the girls' restroom because I thought nobody would want to eat with me. Now, nothing said that. There was nothing in my life that said that. It was the ism just driving me nuts. And so when I was 21 years old and took a drink, it was like, Eureka! This is the answer to life. I found it. Now I have the answer. Now I know what to do. Now I know what it's like. Now I can live. Now I can be a part of. I can talk. I'm not shy. I can dance. I did a lot of things that I would probably not want to talk about from this podium, but it was the drink that just cleaned it all up for me, just gave me the answers, and I was fine with that drink. And I actually drank for 10 years before I looked like an alcoholic. I can assure you I was an alcoholic before I ever had the first one. But it was 10 years before I actually looked like one. And the reason for that was that I was so terrified that I would turn out to be like my father that I was rigidly controlling that drinking. Dr. John Mooney said, you know, we have controlled drinking and uncontrolled drinking. And I managed to be a controlled drinker for 10 years and have 2 drinks on Friday night and 2 drinks on Saturday night. My husband's father was an alcoholic too, so we didn't at that time keep it in the home. Later, we began to keep it in the home, and later we began to have children in a rather repetitive, obnoxious, monotonous manner. I had 3 babies in 3 years. And so the addictions were just going on all over the place back then. So, and cigarettes was another addiction for me. So I just had all the addictions. And so after I had those babies, I did not want to be a smoking mother. So I quit smoking. And everything changed. I was nuts. I was crazy. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sit still. I was up at 1:30 in the morning trying to do things. Busy, 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 busy and around. And one of the doctors I've worked with as a therapist has said that that if you look back far enough in every alcoholic's life, you'll find a period of mania. Well, this was my period of mania. I was up and up and up and up, sleeping an hour, up again. And I went to the doctor and I said, I'm going crazy. I'm going crazy. And he said, well, darling, it's your nerves. And just take these little pills. And so he gave me, what all did he give me? Valium, Librium, Cinequan, Elavil, Triavil, Secanol, Tuinol, Nimbutal, anything at all. And I became addicted to every one of those that was addictive. And he said to me, Mrs. Curry, there are just thousands of medications, and we just need to find the one that will be the right one for you and will not allow you to drink so much. Well, that's what I want, Doc. That's what I want. But this man was a psychiatrist. He was the first psychiatrist I saw, and he folded his arms like this, and he said, hello, Mrs. Curry. And those were his last words. For an hour. And then he said, time's up, Mrs. Curry. We will continue next week. Now, I might have been sobbing. I might have been bawling. Time's up, Miss Curry. We'll see you next week. And I continued to do that for a year with this man never saying a word to me, just drilling me, filling me with drugs and all kinds of medicines to the extent that I couldn't function. So after a year, I said, I am not going to do this anymore, Dr. So-and-so. I just can't do it. And I said, I want to tell you, thank you for what you've tried to do, and I'm going to tell you goodbye. And I got up to leave, and he said, well, Mrs. Curry, I am only sorry you did not use your time more wisely. But I want to tell you how good God is. God doing for me what I could never have done for myself. That would have been in 71. And about 15 years later, the chief psychiatrist for an organization in Washington, D.C., called me and said, Tony, I have a man I want you to evaluate. Five psychiatrists have screwed up this case, and I want you to evaluate this man, and I want you to get me the right diagnosis. Well, that man walked in my office, and a three-year-old could have diagnosed him, and I got the right diagnosis, and that man is sober 25 years today. And he was a cousin of this psychiatrist who had said, Mrs. Curry, I'm just sorry you didn't handle your time more wisely. God is so good. He healed me from that painful time of the past and gave me a wonderful moment to live with, that I could help this man's cousin, even though that man couldn't help me because he didn't have the right things to help me with and didn't understand the right problem. But I could help this man's cousin. It was just God doing for me what I could not do for myself. A wonderful moment. Well, then I was referred to Emory Psychiatric Hospital, where they told me I was not an alcoholic and that I should go home and drink socially. I had marital problems and emotional problems. My diagnoses there were paranoid schizophrenia, manic depressive illness, which was the bipolar of the day, and endogenous depression. Those were my diagnoses. And so he said, we're going to help you get through these things, and you can drink socially. You can just go home and drink socially. So I bought a gallon of wine on the way home from the hospital to practice drinking socially. And he referred me to a psychiatrist who I was to see three times a week. This man thought I had a Thorazine deficiency. And so he just prescribed massive doses of Thorazine. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody on Thorazine, but we look really interesting. We can't walk like other people do. You know, you can't jaunter down the sidewalk swinging your arms. You can't do that on Thorazine. Your arms are plastered to your side. You can't move them, and you just shuffle. This is the way you do it. You just shuffle. So the next year, I shuffled around, Scott, for about a year, driving the car, carpooling children to school and to activities. And one day, the druggist said, Miss Curry, I just hope you're not driving an automobile while you're taking this medication. You shouldn't be doing. In fact, Miss Curry, you really need to be lying down in bed. You shouldn't be doing anything on this medication. But my doctor said I have to have it. Well, you know, I'm telling you, Miss Curry, you need to be in bed. Don't drive a car, please. Don't drive a car. Don't put your children in a car with you. So that's the way it went. The doctor said, are you going to listen to your druggist? Are you going to listen to your doctor? And he said something that was so fascinating to me. He said that Thorazine would help me to organize my thoughts. Well, my experience with Thorazine was that it stripped me of the ability to think. So we didn't have to worry about organizing thoughts. And so that's the way that went. And he said another thing that I will never, ever forget the longest day I live. He said, Miss Curry, you are so mentally ill and you are so ill-equipped to cope with life. You will never be able to live a day of your life without Thorazine. And I can remember that day thinking, if this is, I mean, it makes you feel awful if you don't need it. And don't misunderstand me, because Thorazine does work very well with certain diagnoses, but not alcoholism. And so I just was thinking about how awful I felt. And if I have to feel this way the rest of my life, I do not want to live. I don't want to go on. I'd rather be dead than to feel this way. It's a miserable feeling for an alcoholic. But I didn't exactly want to die. You know, I just wanted to get well, and I thought I was at the pinnacle of how you get well. The psychiatrist is the last place you go. And I thought, I'm here, and I'm failing at the psychiatrist, and what else can I do? And so that went on. My husband was not very happy with me, I might add. He was a little disgusted. He wanted me to get my act together and stop drinking and stop embarrassing him. He had, most recently, we had that summer been to Isla Mirada, Florida. He was an invitational tarpon tournament fishermen. And so 25 people were all over the country were invited to Isla Mirada once a year. We always went. It was a big social world, big social world. And he had met this guy who was president of a Coca-Cola company in another city. And he said, Tony, I want you to help me impress this man because I really like him. And I think that he could help us a lot. And I want you to impress him. So I said, okay, I will, and I did. That night at the banquet, the largest social function of the entire week, I leaned down to kiss him on the cheek, and my wig fell off in his dinner plate. So I was asked to leave Isla Mirada, and I actually have never seen it since, and that's been a lot of years ago. So I'm sure Isla Mirada was glad to get rid of me, too, so... but he was furious. He was livid, and he wanted me to get my act together, and I just couldn't do it. Well, he hired a private detective to follow me, and I only knew that because my father told me that a private detective was following me, that the telephone was tapped, and that he was watching every move I made. My daddy was saying, well, you got to be real careful now. And so I was terrified. Now, how am I going to get my booze? You know, I'm being followed. The telephone's tapped. I can't go in a liquor store. I can't go in a beer store. What am I going to do? Well, one day at the drugstore, I noticed that a Micron mouthwash had 18% alcohol. And I bought it, and it worked. Not quite as tasty, but it worked. And so I went back and bought another bottle of Micron, and then I found Scope, and then I found Cepacol, and I had the sweetest breath in town for a long, long time. And then I went to the hard drugs. I found vanilla flavoring that had 68% alcohol and lemon extract that had 84% alcohol, and I was about a 10 bottle a day. You know, of those things, there's only about that big, so you have to drink a lot. And I was talking to a man one time, and he said, you know, it is the funniest thing. You smell just like cookies. So that's probably going to go on my tombstone, the lady who smelled like cookies. But that's the way it was going. And, you know, when I have to, it's embarrassing to stand here and tell you that if what you drink the most of is your drug of choice, the last 2 years I drank, my drug of choice was vanilla flavoring. That's so embarrassing. It's horrible. It's not like I didn't have the money. My husband was wealthy. It's not like I didn't have the money to go to a liquor store. But I was not going to let that private detective see me walking in a liquor store. No, sir. He was not going to get the goods on me. So I had to be very careful about what I drank. And so that was not going to go on for a long time. And we were divorced. And if ever I thought I was in trouble as a married alcoholic, I had no earthly idea how much trouble I could get into as a single female alcoholic on the streets of Atlanta, Georgia. But the book says our stories disclose in a general way, so don't get your hopes up. It was tough. The worst part of that year was actually that three children were the parents in the household. Miraculously, I was allowed to keep the children. And he had promised me I would never have that opportunity if we were divorced. But he did let me keep the children, only if I did not drink. I could not drink at all. That was written into the contract. And so I didn't drink for 9 months. And I'm here to tell you that if I added up all the days that I drank the last 2 years of my drinking, it probably would not come to 100 days. But I was in worse shape at the end of those 2 years than I had been 2 years earlier when I'd been drinking every day. I was in worse shape because every time I stopped and went back, I was worse. And this time I stopped for 9 months when we were divorced, and I thought, I can do it. It's my husband who's the problem, and now I'm going to get rid of him, that so-and-so, and I'm going to be okay to drink. I'll be able to handle it now. So 9 months without a drink, and then on a Monday I decided, you know, I believe I'll have a drink today. So I had a drink on Monday, Brookins, and on Friday I was in Northside Hospital having my stomach pumped out. 5 days is all it took for me to be in a hospital having my stomach pumped out. This is after I had already been to a second psychiatric facility, which I failed to mention because I don't remember it. And so I don't know what to tell you about that second psychiatric facility. I was so doped up on Thorazine and Melaril and Stelazine and God knows what all that I have no recollection of that facility. Now I've been in another third psychiatric facility having my stomach pumped out. And I went home and I thought I could drink. So I continued drinking. And my children were the parents in that household for the next year. And I tell them that, or part of a year, not the whole year, part of a year. I tell them they did a good job because I turned out all right. And I tell them they did a real good job as the parents in that household. And they are all three really great children. And they are really good children. And I probably wouldn't even be standing here if it weren't for them right now in my life. But they did their own caretaking. They took care of me. They cooked the dinners. They got themselves to school, got themselves home from school. And they were the parents in that household. They raised an alcoholic. That's what my son mentioned that the other day. He said, well, during that time, I was raising you. I couldn't be bothered with other things. He said, I was raising you, and that's the truth. So at any rate, things were not going to last. And in November of that year, I drank on top of an abuse. I tried many times to stop. I tried as hard as an alcoholic could try to stop drinking. I took an abuse. I drank on top of it. And I was very ill, very, very ill. And the last time I drank on top of it, I fell on a wooden chair, cracked my head open, and my son had the presence of mind and the responsibility of calling an ambulance, my parents, a doctor, and my son was 8 years old. And my daughters had the responsibility of dragging mom to a bed and mopping up the blood off the white carpeting. And my daughters were 5 and 6 years old. And that is alcoholism, Barbara, and all you great Al-Anons out there. It is what we do to our families that makes this the most dreadful disease in the world. You know, I wish that I'm the only one who could have suffered from this disease. I wish it could have just been me. But it was my children who suffered and who worried and who cried and who were scared to death. And what my alcoholism did to them, that's what alcoholism really is. Well, I lost full and permanent custody of my children that day. They were taken away from me, and I knew they were never coming back. It was the worst day. All I ever wanted to be in my life was a mother. That's my only desire, was my only goal. And I had failed at the only thing I ever wanted to do. I was a failure. And I felt like dying. I felt like suiciding. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. I never could do it. But that's the way I felt, and it was terrible. Well, when we moved into that condo, and as I am supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, this is what happened. I moved into a condo that I thought was far away from everybody that knew me. I didn't know a soul in this little area. It wasn't even a city. And I loved this little condo. It was away from everybody. Nobody would be on my back about my drinking. And I was just crazy about it. And the kids and I had really some good times there. But in the fall of the year, I'm lying in bed drunk, sometimes crawling to the bathroom, sometimes not eating, sometimes eating. The children are helping themselves. And I had a double window in my bedroom, and I looked out that window, and there was a building, a long, low, flat building being built in my backyard, right in my backyard here. And I said, that looks like a school. That's the architecture of schools, these long, low, flat buildings. isn't this the luck? Now my kids are going to be able to walk out the back door and go to school on their own, and I will no longer have to drive 10 miles across town to their private school four times a day to drop off, pick up one, two, and three, four times a day, and stay in the right stage of drunkenness to be able to drive the curvy roads. And it was a challenge. It was a real challenge. Now here is a long, low school being built right in my backyard, and my kids are going to be able to go to school there. They won't have to go to the other school. Well, that building turned out to be Peachford Hospital for the Treatment of Alcoholism, built in my backyard. And that, Tony read that. It is written on page 84 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And that's what it was. And I would be patient number 97 to that hospital. And I was admitted, I was admitted in a long black evening dress that I'd had on for 4 days. And that infamous wig that was on, they tell me, a little lopsided, that I'd had on for 4.5 years. I must have been a sight to behold at 7 a.m. on Monday morning at Peachford Hospital. I'll bet they had a heyday with me in staff meeting. They were changing staffs as I was coming in, so two staffs got the benefit of this long black evening dress at 7 a.m. in the morning. So, but what had preceded that is that on Thursday night I went out with this guy, whom I don't even remember, and he didn't drink enough to suit me. And so I told him I was sick, I didn't feel good, and I needed to come home. So he brought me home. I stood in the foyer, watched him leave, made sure his car had rounded the complex, and then I got in my car and I went to this little piano bar where I knew I could drink a lot and sing a lot. And good music. It was the music that was really the attraction there for me, not the drinking. It was the music. And so I went there, and that is the last memory that I have, is sitting at that piano bar, probably singing off key. And the next memory I have is I was sitting in a living room, still in my long black evening dress, only now it is Saturday morning. And you don't have to worry about getting your hopes up about that story, because I don't remember it either. I had been in a blackout since Thursday night, and now it is Saturday morning. I'm sitting in a room with five other people that I have never seen before. We are sitting in we're sitting in the living room, and we're all in conversation. I had no idea, Dick, who they were. I had no idea. I had never seen any of them before. I didn't know how I hooked up with them. I didn't know what we had done, God forbid. And I was terrified, and I couldn't let you know. I couldn't let them know. I mean, you know how it is. You just search faces, hoping that you're going to get a clue for who these people are. And no clues were coming. And somebody said, let's go to Friday's and for champagne brunch. Yeah, yeah, let's go to Friday's. I need a drink. So we go to Friday's and we start drinking again. And then one guy said, Tony, when we get through here, I'll take you to your car. Yay, I have a car, and he knows where it is. And I'm going to be able to get home. And so he took me to that car. I went straight, bought a gallon of vodka, and I have no other memories until Monday morning, when I decided sometime around 5 or 6 a.m. to go to Peachford Hospital in my long black evening dress that I had on for 4 days. So that's how it started for me, and that's what happened and how it started for me. And it was at Peachford Hospital that I learned that I could stay sober. Our friend Conway ran that program, and the people he had working for him were all people like you in this room. And, you know, we hardly had any sobriety. We were fresh out of DTs. I spent 3 days in DTs in the detox ward. And then they hired me 18 days after I was discharged. So this tells you what kind of shape I was in. Working in detox, I'm just so grateful nobody died, because we were not we were not the proper counselors to be treating anybody anywhere. But we stayed sober, and we had a wonderful program there. We really did. And in spite of that, I did, girls, what they told us not to do. They told me to go to meetings. I went to meetings. I had five sponsors, a husband and wife team, and one who was a spiritual advisor, and one who was an educational advisor who taught me, was always teaching me about the disease, and then one who helped me to recover from the loss of my children, knowing that they were not coming back. And so those were my five sponsors. I stuck to them, and at 6 months, I decided that, you know, I know that they say don't get involved in a relationship, but I work in this hospital. I am weller than these other people. I can handle a relationship. And so I got involved with this young man. I had 6 months, he had 6 months, and it happened exactly like they promised. 3 months later, he was drinking. My sponsor said, "You've got to get away from him." I said, "Oh no, I'm going to help him get back to sobriety." And 3 months later, I was drinking with him, and I wound up having to go into treatment again, and that's why my birthday is not in February, but May 3rd of 1975. When I came back, when I went into William Way Hospital, and my nursing supervisor came down there as my family and went through the family program as my family, because I had no one to go through that program with me. And she couldn't bear the thought, Alice Hamilton, she couldn't bear the thought that I would be by myself without family down there. So she came and went through the program as my family. And wanted me to come back to work at Peachford. And I said, "Oh, no." And Dr. John said, "Yes, you are. You're going back to Peachford because we are now required to have an aftercare program. And none of us know what that looks like. And I want you to go back up there. You can't be a counselor now. You just got out of treatment. You've got to sit in an office and research aftercare and find out what it's like and put an aftercare program for Peachford and then teach the rest of us how to do that." Gave God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Never did I in a million years believe that aftercare was going to become my career. Did I ever believe that? God doing for me. And that is my whole story of God doing for me. I am not responsible for any wonderful thing that has happened in my sobriety or any a part of the wonderful careers I've had in this sobriety. I'm not responsible for any of it. It has been brought to me. I have been pursued by other people to do things. God has done for me what I could not do for myself. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I went to another 90 meetings in 90 days, and I went to a meeting every day for 2 years. And as I had accepted the fact that my children were never coming back, that they were better off where they were. There was lots of money over there. I made about $3 an hour. And so I had decided that that was what it was going to be. And I began to get calls. My ex-mother-in-law began to call me and say, "Tony, you need to do something about your children." This is my ex-mother-in-law. It's telling me I need to get the children back. I said, "Mama Curry, I just don't believe I can. What if God doesn't mean for me to have the children? What if I were to screw up again and ruin their lives again?" I said, "I just can't do that to them again. I just have to love them from where I am." Kept calling, kept begging me to do something. The housekeeper who had worked for me all the years that my children were young and I was drunk, she had never seen me sober. And she called and said, "Miss Tony, you've got to do something about your children." And to make a long story short, I was actually forced by God and my sponsors into filing for custody of my children that year. It was a frightening thing because I made $3 an hour. My husband was a millionaire. And I just thought, how in the world is this going to work? And kids would come over and they would say, "Well, Mom, you know, we just really are listening to them say awful things about you. They said you ran Grandpa down with a car. They said you hit him in the face and broke his glasses and cut his face all up. They said you were always passed out on the floor with no clothes on." And I said, "Angie, honey, you know, I know I did all those things, but I did all those things. No, she said, I said, Angie, don't listen, don't listen. And she said, but Mom, I know you did all things, but just did all those things, but just don't tell the judge or we'll never get to live with you. And what a great moment that was, that they really were wishing to live with me and that maybe that would happen. And we went to court that July. We were all scheduled to come to the Atlanta Roundup, and we were in court on that Friday, and I was on the witness stand for 5 hours telling all the gory details about my drunkenness and also sharing my spiritual journey. And when I shared the spiritual journey, nobody in there understood alcoholism, and you could have heard a pin drop when I shared coming to my relationship with God and what I had learned from Alcoholics Anonymous about how to live my life. You could have heard a pin drop. And my sponsor was asked to testify, the husband and wife team, who were like surrogate parents to me. They were my parents. They were my sponsors. They were my educators, my spiritual advisors. They were everything to me. Lived next door, and I worked with them. I saw them all day, every day. They were just a godsend to me. And they asked Jimmy to testify. Jimmy said, they said, Jimmy, Mr. Johnson, will you tell us that this woman will be sober next week? And he said, no, I can't tell you if anybody in this room will be sober next week. He said, we cannot predict the future. And those were just about his last words. He suffered. He got down from the witness stand. And he took his wife, Johnny, outside, and he said, honey, if we had written a script, we could not have written the script that God has written in this courtroom today. He said, I think we have 3 new grandchildren today. Let's go get a cup of coffee and celebrate. And he fell dead of a heart attack at that moment. He was gone. And I thought I had killed him. That testifying for me had killed him. And if it hadn't been for all the people, like these people in Atlanta, Georgia, who knew us and loved us, I don't think I would have ever gotten through that. But because of the love of Alcoholics Anonymous and the care, Johnny got through and I got through without a drink, without a pill, without anything. And we were assigned people to be with us 24 hours a day. A doctor took care of helping us be with somebody all the time. And an autopsy showed that Jimmy had terminal cancer behind an eye that nobody even knew about. The doctor had told him, but he had not told Johnny. And we didn't know that. And you and Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta, Georgia, helped me to understand that I did not kill Jimmy, that I did not make that decision. And he was allowed to die, at least with a smile on his face, and not a painful cancer death, saying, let's go get a cup of coffee and celebrate. Well, that was the trauma of that day. And the beautiful part of that day is I was given my children. And they would tell you today that that was the best thing that ever happened to them, that we got to live together and there was so much love and fun in our house. And they would tell you today that that was the best thing that could have happened to them. And I'm so proud of all of them today. Well, my life just soared. I mean, my life has soared. I was the aftercare director there. The aftercare program became a model for other programs. I'm going to hurry up here. Model for other programs, and people were coming from all over the country trying to learn how to put an aftercare program together for treatment centers. I was being asked to go to consult with other hospitals to put aftercare programs together. I was placed on the task force of Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals, placed on their aftercare task force. God doing for me what I could not do for myself. You know, I had just done what Dr. John told me to do, and it was just leading to so many other things. And then a group of group of women and men came to me and said, "We're going to build a hospital on the down by the airport. We'd like for you to be one of the founders with us." And I was able to be a founder of Anchor Hospital in Atlanta, which is still a wonderful hospital. I'm not connected to it at all anymore, so I'm not responsible for whatever's going on there now. I'm not responsible. But I hired the original staff. I wrote parts of the program, wrote all of the aftercare program, and had a wonderful experience there for a long time. Then the governor of Georgia appointed me to the Governor's Advisory Council on Mental Health. I didn't even know the governor of Georgia knew my name. God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And to the Commission on Drug Awareness and Prevention, appointed me to that commission. And let me tell you how good God is again. 1973, I had a DUI. And I came to within a car moving forward with a screen between me and the front seat. And I said, "Sir, where are we going?" He said, "We're going to jail." And I said, "No, you can't take me to jail. I'm a lady." And he said, "Well, lady, you are going to jail." And I spent a horrible, miserable night sobering up real fast in that DeKalb County jail. 13 years later, the governor of Georgia appointed me as the chairperson of the DUI Assessment Task Force, which included DeKalb County, Georgia. Yay, God is so good. God doing for me again. And then a group of doctors came to me and said, "We're going to open a hospital in Cannes, France, and we would like for you to help us do that." So I became one of the founders of the International Recovery Center in Cannes, France. And we were over there opening that hospital. The royalty had sent letters condoning what we were doing and congratulating us. And we were cavorting around on the Riviera. I was, I think, 55 at that time. So I did not. I decided to spare the people of France from watching a 55-year-old woman go topless. So, but there were plenty of them over there, topless and bottomless too, I'll tell you. It was a wonderful experience, and there was a huge problem with alcoholism in France. So that was a wonderful experience. And so I've just had the most incredible opportunities in my life. I've been given my children back, career opportunity after another that I never pursued, never once pursued. Everything has come to me, God doing for me what I would not do for myself probably. And I'm just so grateful. AA has, the program of AA teaching me how to live my life has given me everything I ever was looking for as that little girl who was terrified of life and couldn't move, just stricken, paralyzed. And I have just loved all of you in AA. I love alcoholics. I just think we're a different group and that we are the blessed people of the world and that we have a way of living through this program that just makes life wonderful. It makes life so much easier, and even in the midst of challenges, God has given me a new challenge. Let me see if I can get through this. On September 2nd, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I was walking around like a deer in the headlights for about a month. I just couldn't bear it. I couldn't believe it. I said, "But God, I have 12 grandchildren. I have 8 grandchildren under 5 who won't even know me if I go now." I was just begging God. But my children, they told me at Emory that it was inoperable and that I should get my affairs in order. My children refused to let their mother go. So they got on the internet, manic, night and day on the internet, and found a doctor at Johns Hopkins Hospital and said, "Mom, we're going to Johns Hopkins. We're not going to do this. We're going to Johns Hopkins." And so they all took me up there and Tony. And so I'm going to have surgery on December the 23rd. And I am comfortable with this. I may be crying because it's poignant. But I am comfortable with this. Dick and Barbara have been my greatest resources. And I am okay. I am okay with this. I feel so grateful that my children have taken this route. And I believe that I believe in what they're doing. I believe in this doctrine. I believe in what we're doing. And so I'm going to be around for this next year. We're going to do this again next year, and I'm going to see you here. And I feel very buoyed. I have learned another miracle about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is the power of prayer. I have never seen anything like Dick Anderson and Barbara were speaking at the Connecticut State Convention and asked 2,000 people to bow in silence for 2 minutes. He started everything and let everybody know. The cards and letters and calls and prayers have, Duke, even though you look at me tearful right now, have kept me uplifted. And I feel very grateful that I have all of you in my life and that I have this opportunity that a lot of people don't have. So I am grateful to be here. I'm going to be at Woodstock of the South next year, and what a concept. Woodstock's over. It is great. And thank you for letting me be here.